Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Mind Shifters Radio with the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael Rice. I'm Jeannie Rice, your co-host. We also have co-hosts Dr. Tim Hayes and Michelle Bichette. We will share with you the wisdom of the first century Aramaic internal process of forgiveness. We offer tools and support 5 days a week. We will support you in building a solid foundation within yourself to live in pure love, in Aramaic, Brachma. Michael is the author of the book, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? For more information about the forgiveness process, please visit www.whyagain.org. And now, welcome to the show, Mind Shifters Radio.
Hello and welcome to Mind Shifters Radio. I'm Tim Hayes. I'm your host for the first hour. And today is Monday, May 30th, 2022. And today will be a replay of the interview with Dale Ellen Hoffman that was done a couple of years ago. Happy Memorial Day. Blessings. We are pleased to be able to have Dale Ellen Hoffman here today. Dale Ellen Hoffman is an ancient Aramaic wisdom keeper and energetic healer sharing long-suppressed ancient secrets and healing modalities. He's published numerous audio and video programs and is author of the book Echoes of an Ancient Dream, Aramaic Toning on the Path of Light. Dale is a civilian scholar, a mystic and healer. He brings ancient insight for the present moment. And rather than studying religious history from within the orthodoxy of theological institutions, Dale chose to step off the track of religious programming and take a path less traveled. He encourages others to stop, quote, eating from the menu that's being served, and instead embrace an honest, balanced exploration of the actual, authentic history of the Yeshua teachings in all of its manifestations. Dale travels internationally, sharing the experiential philosophies veiled beneath millennia of misunderstandings, beneath skewed translations, and a general lack of perception. Dale has published numerous audio and video programs, and Echoes of an Ancient Dream is his first book. Dale, I think I just turned on your microphone. Are you there?
I think you did. It's great to hear your voice.
Well, I can say the same thing. I've got to just stop here and be with my breath for a minute. I'm getting one of those God bump moments. Thank you for being here.
Oh, absolutely. You asked and I said yes instantly, so of course.
Well, how would you like to spend this hour, sir? I am at your service.
Oh, I can go in any direction. It's probably easier for you to maybe just start with some questions or something along those lines.
Okay.
And
well,
see where we go.
What I'll say is that I've been promoting your appearance here, and I've been talking to people about, as I reread the book recently, it was quite difficult for me to not fill my shows in this past few weeks and then, you know, basically spoil your appearance because they've had me read the book to them basically page by page. I've also had a request out, and we've had several people submit questions, one from Australia, one from North Carolina, one from Philadelphia, and there might be a couple others that I've missed in the emails. But what I've said as I talk about your work, basically what we're reading here off the back of your book, that the thing that draws me to your work is the fact that we're not just doing academic study. And you do recognize the value of the academic study, and you talk about standing on the shoulders of those giants who've done that work and how you have made a life practice of putting it into an experiential day-to-day practice for yourself. So what part of the early goings of your introduction to this do you want to share with us without having them to read the whole book, which I highly recommend to people?
Well, the books a very easy read. The first section is just kind of stories about how I got into it, and I can dig into a little of that. I mean, for me, it really, the church was always around on some level for me from the time I was born, because my grandmother, Irene, was a pillar in the Methodist church, the local Methodist church where I grew up in southern New Jersey, kind of across the Delaware River from Philadelphia in the farmlands, believe it or not, of the Garden State. And she was, there's still, if you go there to that church today, there's still photographs of her hung up in the hallways and stuff. And then we would also, my brother and sister and I would also walk across town after the Methodist service and go to an Episcopalian service, which, you know, I recognize now as like Catholic light. It's like same great taste, less filling, you know, less calories. But didn't have the fire and the brimstone, but it had the beautiful pageantry, which really enchanted me. And it was, what, the summer of 1979, and I did what, you know, all kids do. At the age of seven, I sat down on my grandmother's floor and I laid out five Bibles and I compared them to each other. And they were, I was actually looking at the Beatitudes, which I still have the Bible, my Bible that my grandmother gave to my mother in the 50s, I think 1956, and my mother didn't really have any use for it because Elvis was out by then, so she had other things to do, and it still has my mom's name on it. But I sort of got that Bible from her when I was 5 years old. And I actually went through in the beginning and scrawled down my favorite Beatitudes. It's not, I don't think that's something that, you know, most kids that age do. Probably when I was five or six. When I was seven, I started comparing all these Bibles together. And I was just struck because they were all very different from one another. There was a King James, a New King James, which are totally different from each other. A 1611 King James, a Greek, what's called Lexicon Bible. And I don't know what the fifth one was. And I was just struck by, there was enough differences that I was confused because everybody told me, look, this is the Word of God. I don't know that I had the word inerrant in my head yet, but it was like, this is the Word of God. So God said this. And I was really confused. I'm like, well, if God said it, why is it so different? And then I started digging into my grandmother's other Bibles and all the different books she had about it. And I was just totally baffled. And I said to her, I don't understand this. Why is it so different if it's God, if God said this? She said, well, you have to take that on faith. And I went, okay. And I said, what's faith? And then the exact phrase that she gave me was, faith develops in time through faith. And I went, okay, confused. So she said, go talk to the pastor on Sunday. And I asked him. I got the exact same response. So I realized I wasn't, I don't know what it was. Even when I was young, I noticed people were doing things, they were stepping in footprints, they were doing processes or doing particular things, but I didn't see, I could tell that the life, the vitality, even as a kid, wasn't there. For some reason, what they were doing, they're going, they're saying the prayers, they're doing these steps to that and this steps to that. And even though they're stepping in those footprints, kind of like Arthur Murray Dance Studio, you know, you just put your footprints, you know, where you got to go and you learn the dance moves. It still, something wasn't happening in them. And I was really interested why I would meet certain people that seemed to be lit up about the Bible, about God, about Jesus, and they couldn't quote me stuff out of the Bible, but I could just feel the tenderness in their heart. There was a lot of people at the nursing home down the street from me that I would sit on these benches, especially this old guy, Mikey, cantankerous old guy, smoked. Took him like 2 minutes to get the cigarette into his mouth. He was griping about everything, but he was such a sweet, pure guy at the same time. And he would, like, he just was a really good soul. I would watch him open the doors for people, do things that I noticed a lot of the people that were banging the Bible and holding it up weren't doing. Or maybe they were doing it in front of people, and when they weren't around people, they weren't. I was recognizing that stuff, and I just kept digging in myself. And then by the time I was teen, I started writing down a lot of these a lot of phrases from the, you know, what Jesus said. A lot of it was in red in one of my Bibles, not the one that was my mom's, but a lot of that was in red, and I would write that down, and then I would write 5 pages about what I felt that meant. And I wasn't writing it because somebody needed to see it. It wasn't that at all. I wrote it because I had to, and I had experiences like in vacation Bible school during the summer where I remember looking at the page, and this is something I didn't talk about until I put it in my book because I didn't want people looking at me, oh, well, then Dale's special. You know, that word, I'd just rather keep that one. Special as in unique, sure. Special as in better somehow, or I got some sort of whatever that somebody else didn't get that I'm not interested in hearing. But I remember looking down at, we were talking about lay up for yourself treasures in heaven where moth and rust do not destroy, and everybody's talking about heaven as if it's a place you go to after you die. And I'm looking at it going, it doesn't say that, though. It's not what it says here. It's not talking about that at all. It's talking about something like now. It's talking about right now. And I looked down at the page of the Bible, and I saw layers. I saw different what I recognize now as languages. I recognized one as Greek. I recognized one as what one would call Hebraic or even classical, pre-Estrangella Aramaic. I throw too many terms out there, but... And I saw these different languages in different colors, kind of like an outline going deeper into the page. And I remember putting my hand over it because it felt like it was glowing, and I didn't feel anything. And then all of a sudden I realized that the lights are off in the room. And I went, well, that's odd, and it's really quiet. And I look up, and the room's empty except for me, but there's the teacher who was one of the kids in the class, it was his mom, looking at me like I was guilty of something, and she's looking at me, and she's like, are you coming? And I just kind of got up, and I realized my face must have been white as a ghost, because I had no clue what was happening. And I remember walking out, I remember the smell of the church, and we're walking down the tile floor, going out the one door and down the brick steps and outside, out behind the church. And all of a sudden, I'm just looking around, and I'm noticing that it's like I can see little lights in the trees, and I can hear this really high, not a squeal, it was like this shine, things shine. They look like they shine, and I could hear it. And, you know, the best way I would explain it today is it's almost like as if I had, like was listening to music or something through a speaker with a blanket over it, and I didn't realize the blanket was over it. All of a sudden, I got it sounding as good as I possibly could. I'm like, wow, that sounds great. And then you lift the blanket off. There was this presence. There was this awareness. And I remember standing there, and all the other kids are playing, running around, screaming their brains out, and that teacher still standing there looking at me outside, and I'm just standing there, probably with my jaw hanging, white as a ghost, going, whoa, like, what is this? And I sensed that, you know, over and over in the woods, and then I'd come back into sort of normal everyday life, and, you know, I wouldn't find it, but I noticed that Jesus was talking about finding that in everyday life, and I could tell what he was talking about by heaven. I knew what that meant. I knew what the kingdom meant. I knew what all these different things were, although, you know, I had zero chance of putting them into words yet, but when I was 14, I started trying to put it into words, and then doing my best to step into it and live it. And I started just really paying close attention to even like my breathing and my heartbeat. And I would lay back in the stream down below my home and go into the irrigation tunnel underneath the road and do this toning and stuff like that. I mean, all listening to my voice coming back 1,000 times over because of the ripples in the pipe, you know, that was under the ground. And I was having these really profound experiences, and I wasn't talking about them with my friends, so I didn't know they weren't having them. But that really sort of was, I don't want to say it's a foundation. It was the opposite. It wasn't a foundation so much as it was such a dramatic, profound opening, like a portal was opening for me within myself that a foundation wasn't able to form. And I think that's where the spark really comes from, at least for me, is because give me the humility. I'm not interested in forming some kind of dogma around what I'm doing or saying or even my interpretations or whatever. You know, I'm doing my best to help people find that within themselves because I know I found it within myself. And a lot of it I can't put into words. You know, I know what a lot of Aramaic words or terms mean, but I would never dare put them in English because I wouldn't know how. It would take me 5 pages to put one word into English sometimes. But I know how it feels. And that's, you know, that's always been the thing that's led me forward. You know, it's like when I'm with my daughter, our 8-year-old, our youngest, her name's Shemaya, which is the word heaven or sky in Aramaic. The ayah sound at the end means something that has no boundary or is just consistently growing, growing, growing. When I'm with her, I'm able to really be wholly, fully present. And, you know, when I was really deep in the academics, it's great and it's exciting. But the thing, I have to be honest, that the thing that I had a lot of frustration about was everybody was saying something different and everybody was saying they were correct. And then I would watch someone get a hold of things that were really great and really profound and then almost basically turn it into like a religion or turn it into like boil it down and harden it into something that, especially in the academic world, they would boil it down and let it harden so that they couldn't see the forest for the trees anymore. They weren't able to really find the magic in that thing that's right there in front of them. They couldn't see in the Aramaic or Hebrew the word sod, which is the word secret, which doesn't mean secret like, you know, the secret mystery schools. That didn't mean you weren't allowed to know they were there necessarily, or you were never allowed to hear that. What it actually means is that you've got something you've had in your hand right here in front of your face. You've had it in front of your face for, you know, days, weeks, years, and you've never seen it. You've never seen its true nature. You've only ever seen the essentially the codes, the frames, the beliefs that you project upon it. But then all of a sudden you have this moment where you know, you take a big breath in the nose, out the mouth, and all of a sudden it reveals itself. And it was like the academics allowed me a couple of things. One, it allowed me to understand that nobody truly really knows who wrote this stuff. Nobody truly really knows if Jesus said any of this. Nobody knows, you know, where it comes from. Nobody knows the source of Christianity. You hear all this stuff about the original Greek texts, and everybody says, so many people say they're sourced in Greek, and it's like, well, how many of the originals of the Greek we have? Oh, zero. Yeah, but okay. You start thinking about things like that, and you realize that in the end, what really matters isn't, it's not in the details. It's not in the words of the letters. It's in, am I awake right now? Am I able to be wholly, fully open in this present moment? And that's where the humility, which is that third beatitude, makike, which literally means an open relationship with earth, grounding into the earth. It's where the word humus relates with humility. The Aramaic word makike, that's also in Lakota, which means in Lakota, that means to lay naked on the bare earth without a mat. And I realized that it wasn't in the books, it wasn't in the pages, it was in me. And I was only able to see, when I was deep in the academics, I was only able to see almost like what was put into me on some level. If I was going to do what everybody else was doing, I couldn't do that. I had to go off the path. I had to go look. You know, I'd go to these symposiums, and they're looking at me like I've got lobsters crawling out of my ears, because I'm like, y'all are arguing about these things, and you're screaming at each other in English and Hebrew at this one Semitic conference down in Tampa, and they're tearing each other apart. And cheesy little Dale, I'm like, has anybody actually tried to put it into practice? Maybe finding out if it actually works, maybe finding out if there's an experience here will tell you if it's real or not, rather than this arguing about what different scholars said. And it was the wildest moment for me, because all these people turned and looked at me in the room like my head turned blue, and then they ignored me and went back to what they were doing again as if I wasn't there. And I was like, well, that's an interesting experience. And I actually had to breathe through that, you know, doing breath work. I had several breath work sessions where that came up and my face got hot. You know, that's the humility, that's the humus, the grounding into the earth. So I realized I had again, not special, but a unique view, maybe, from those experiences I had as a child in the woods and those deep moments with my grandmother, you know, listening to gospel music. I had a certain experiential view and or take on things that I think a lot of people just trying to be by the book didn't have. And I learned to be okay with that. And I learned to be okay with people telling me, I was a blithering idiot because I was saying some of the things I'm saying. And then, of course, the weird thing was years later, some of them come back around and they're talking about it as if they thought it up. And it's like, that's a wild thing to watch. But to me, it's just about being open. And I didn't find a lot of openness in the people that were addicted to the words on the page. And that's the whole midsection of my book, is that seeing beyond the letters on the page, taking some things like that in the beginning was the word, Bereshit Etoihua Milta, in the Gospel of Yohanan and John, and being able to unpack that and say, look, I can go on for six pages about what this word means, and even words that I would have translated it as 10 years ago I wouldn't use today because I realize it's not that either. And there is no direct translation in English. It just doesn't – it's not possible. And that, to me, I love it. I love things like that. But yet you would look at it in these symposiums and a lot of the scholarly stuff, they would hammer down some kind of particular meaning, and then they'd start making beliefs around that, around their whatever. This is the English equivalent of it. The funny thing is there's no English equivalent for the word milta. It just doesn't exist. So it was all about the experience for me. It's still about the experience for me. It doesn't matter what I know, not in the slightest. What matters is, how's my energy? You know, how am I carrying myself in the world? Is my heart open? Is my energy open? Am I in that humility? Am I aware of the earth beneath my feet? Am I aware of the rise and fall of my breath, the beating of my heart? When I'm in those spaces, I can see depth in the teachings and depth in the living of those teachings that I'm not able to see when I'm in some kind of almost like an obsession that some people can get about putting my agenda across and making people bend to that agenda. And I found that over and over in the academic world, and I had to let it go. There's certain scholars I fell in love with, Elaine Pagels, she's like a rock star, Bishop John Shelby Spong, Marcus Borg, but most of them, they just kind of clamp down and they push their view, and that's what they get their sponsorships for, and that's how they make their money. So I had to walk beyond it. I had to just let it go and to be okay with that too. Oh, yeah. Well, we just had the most amazing retreat we've ever offered. It's a funny thing. It's called the Aramaic Path of Initiation. It was a 5-day, 4-night retreat here in Asheville, near Asheville, Mountain Light Sanctuary. And it was really deeply in the living of how we really live this. How do we initiate? And that's a funny thing, too, because when we're taking this Aramaic path of it's called the Aramaic Path of Light rather than initiation to the United Kingdom. We're going to be in Frome, Somerset. We're going to be going to Glastonbury. We're going to be going up onto the Glastonbury Tor, the huge mound with the temple at the top where we're going to be doing Aramaic toning. I'm going to be doing water blessings in the fountain at the Chalice Well, which is King Arthur's waterfall where the water turns red because they said it had the blood of, the Grail, which, of course, the water's red because of iron, but shh. But when I took it when we started taking it to the UK, and we also have one in Sedona in September, Aramaic Path of Light, they were like, well, people aren't going to like the word initiation. And I'm like, well, what's wrong with the word initiation? They're like, well, it sounds cultish. And I'm like, well, this is a great example. Do you know what the word initiate means? People think it means to now, within the last 150 or so years, in English, it's taken on some kind of meaning, understanding of being initiated into something, but that's not what initiation means. To initiate means first cause. Initiate means to start back at the beginning, to go back at the beginning and initiate from that point. It doesn't have to imply anything with something new. But I changed it to light because people are okay with that. But in the retreats, we're doing the breath work. We're doing there's toning. There's deep expression circles where we're sitting in a circle and we've got a crystal or whatever object sitting in the middle. And people go up and they pick that up. And when they've got that in their hand, they've got the floor and they can say whatever they want. It gets very expressive. Things come out. We're literally living the Aramaic Beatitudes, which were a step-by-step process that have completely changed my life. The Beatitudes, especially those from the Gospel of Matthew. But we've got the retreats, one in the UK in September. We've got Sedona, Arizona in October. Those are both already filling up quickly. In the Sedona one, we're going to be doing water blessings in a river in the desert, really amazing. But we've also got them developing in Australia, Slovenia, South Africa, and the Bahamas right now as well. The focus of the work for me, it's still the same, which I think more than anything, speaking of that, the Beatitudes is really a huge core of where I come from.
I'm glad you mentioned that. I was just about
huge
to
core.
Ask you, because we have in the support group that's been running, it'll be 15 years in August, one of the things that got stirred up was the Way of Mastery and JM's work and his Love's Breath and his Aramaic Beatitudes, and we just listened to his Beatitudes again last week. So I wanted to ask you what, because I view those as kind of a yogic practice, as he talks about, and I use it that way. What would you say? How are you looking at the Beatitudes? Take the first few as a step-by-step practice.
Oh, absolutely. Actually, the first three to me are the core of my spiritual life more than anything else. And I have to, you know, do a shout-out to JM, to John Michael, because he, you know, I know he's got, like, a following of people, you know, talking about how he channeled Jeshua. There's no J in Aramaic, which that puzzles me, but I got to say, his Beatitudes, that DVD fell into my hands maybe 15 years ago, and I thought it was spectacular. He really got it. He understood it. What JM's actually doing, the truth of what's happening there, is he's taken Rocco Errico's work, and to an even larger extent, he's taken Neil Douglas Klotz's work, and he's put it into his own words. And I think that's really the honesty of what happened, and I think he's done an amazing job with it. There's, again, in the Beatitudes DVD, there's such a humility there. For me, the core is very simple in the first three Beatitudes, and just to let these out there in Aramaic, Tuve hun la maskeni ibaruch de dil hun himokuta dochmaya, Tuve hun la avile dehanu netbayun, Tuve hun la makike dehanu nertun la arha. Now, that first one, without even going deep into the tuve hun, it's actually a very simple word, a lot more simple than I think people sometimes make it into. I know that Archdeacon Saduk Damar Shamoon simply translated it as a heavenly attitude, but I think the real focus should be on that lomaskene I baruch, that maskin, which was, if you have it in... I don't want to get – see, I can go really deep here in the translation of it and how the error of the poor came into it. But let's just say it was a mistranslation because it was translated from Aramaic into Greek before the phonetic markings were there, before the what's called diacritical marks or the vowel sounds were on the page. And the Aramaic speakers even said they felt so frustrated by those translations that they created an entirely new style of writing called Estrangela or Estrangela, Edessa, so that they could have the phonetic markings, the vowel sounds in there, so there wouldn't be so many errors. They wouldn't be hammering it so bad as they did when they brought it into Greek. But what that first beatitude really means, what maskin means, there's different nuances of what that really means. It doesn't mean poor as in lacking. And the way I explain that is this. Let's say that you've got whatever, $2,000 in your wallet, and you're brand new here to America, and you've never been on American soil before. You don't have anything. You have no job. You have no place to live. You have no luggage. You have nothing except the $2,000 in your wallet. And somebody comes up to you 2 o'clock in the morning, you're walking in a dark alley in New York City, brilliant thing to do, and someone comes and steals that $2,000 out of your wallet. And then what I'll often say in my gatherings is, what are you? And people will say, well, you're poor. If that's all, that was all your income, et cetera, your cash. So that would be what miskin means. If you take the letters, I'm going to give it to you in English, it would be M-S-K-N. And I'll say to my groups, you know, say those, that word. And when you have M-S-K-N, people go miskin, which comes out miskin, which means poor, as in lacking. But when you put the phonetic dots in there, it actually changes it from miskin to maskin. Now, miskin means poor, as in lacking. Maskin is a little bit different. Let's say you've got $2,000 in your wallet, you open it up, and you take the $2,000 out, and you put it out in your front pocket. The wallet is now what? The wallet's empty. And that's what maskin means. Miskin means poor, as in lacking. Maskin means empty, as in open. And there's two other nuances of meaning in that as well. It also means home or sanctuary. It's one of the words for church. So the way that I translate that, it's even the title of my, and I'm sure at some point write a book called Home and Emptiness, but the way I translate that in my Beatitude CDs, the two CD set that I have, is Home and Emptiness. You find your home in the emptiness of Baruch, Baruch. Baruch is that word translated as spirit. But the funny thing about spirit is we've got a tiny, minute, almost what most scholars would say, less than 1% chance that Jesus ever heard the word spiritus in his life, that he ever heard that in the Latin. It's funny because when we think spirit, it's almost like people's arms flap around spirit. It's around, it's within, whatever. But what about if I told you that what that word rucha actually means is frequency or vibration? All of a sudden now it's like, hey, wait a minute. That includes the rise and the fall of your breath. That's the word rucha. That is the beating of your heart, rucha. That's the movement of air on your skin, rucha. It's magnetism, electromagnetism, electricity, solar flares, the energy of the sun, not necessarily the heat, but the effect you feel from that. It means any elemental source that we don't necessarily know why or where it's happening, where it's coming from per se, but we can sense its effects with our senses. So that brings it really, really home. Home in the emptiness of your breath. And that's what I tell people. That's the first step. It's beyond all the theology and all of the framework around it. It's literally, it's being aware of your breath. Or putting your hand over your heart, being aware of the beat of your heart, being aware of the sounds around you. And the way I, you know, put that into English is passive non-resistance, which is my Buddhist, you know, my Buddhist base from my teens and 20s, is that you're, I call it the cosmic question mark above your head. It's like you're just being curious. You're allowing yourself to be in this pure moment with the pure frequency and vibration of the rise and fall of your breath, the movement of the air across your skin, the beating of your heart. If you're sensitive enough in a quiet enough room to actually feel your circulatory system and hear the wheezing of that, to be able to be aware of the sounds in, within, and all around you, and you're aware of those rises and falls, those frequencies and vibrations. That's the first one, is being open in that, empty in that, allowing that. The second, obvile, what that word literally means, like when I often say to people, what, it's one of the words for mourn. Okay, what does mourn mean? I hear people say bewail, and it's like when they use the word bewail, they're using theology. People don't need to hear that. What they need to hear is what it means. What it means when somebody dies and you're in mourning, people usually say, oh, it means I feel bad, blah, blah, blah. What abid or abvile means is to essentially allow the fullness of what you are feeling. How do you allow the fullness of what you're feeling in the moment, whatever it's happiness, sadness, ecstasy, whatever that may be, by the most amazing way I know of is to be aware of the rise and fall of your breath. Number one is breathe. Number two is to feel. And when I say feel, I don't mean emote. When I see all these different philosophies yakking about the power of your thoughts, sorry to tell you, everybody, but even the ancients knew this. Your thoughts don't create anything, because your thoughts are actually the effects of what you're feeling. Feeling is the sensation of pure frequency and vibration. Before any thought you've ever had, you had a feeling. And when I say a feeling, not an emotion. I'm not talking about an emotion that comes from a thought. I'm talking about a feeling. Like you walk into a room and you have zero thoughts going on, but you still have a feeling. And I say to people, you ever been in the room with a baby in the first few hours of its life? Not a lot of thought going on, plenty of feeling happening, pure sensation of frequency and vibration. So the breath is moving, you're allowing yourself to feel it. And the third, makike, what that means is literally to flow. The Tao is like a river flowing home to the sea. Literally in Aramaic, makike means to have an open, naked, unhindered relationship, essentially grounding back into the earth. And I said that in Lakota, that word means to lay naked on the bare earth without a mat. And you notice when you feel the word in English for makike is not meek. There is no meekness there whatsoever. I'm not saying meek is wrong, but it's like 1% out of 100% of the volume of what that can be. It's closer to humility, and humility comes from the Latin root humus, which is that aerated, open layer of earth and soil where water and air can move through. And if you feel humiliated, humiliated, where does your body want to go? It wants to go down into the earth. It wants to ground into the earth. That's what humility is. It's allowing that sacred grounding back into the Mother Earth. So number one, you allow your breath to move. You breathe, you feel, and you allow or flow. And when you allow that, she takes it. And as a matter of fact, the word forgive in Aramaic, shabuk, what shabuk means is literally to remove the root of my suffering. You know how you remove the root of your suffering? You consciously, you're allowing that feeling, you mindfully rise that out of your soil and you drop it back to the earth and she'll take it. It'll ground right back into her. Over and over and over. How many times do you do it? As many times as you need to. 100 times in a 5-minute conversation if you need to. Breathe, feel, allow, slash, flow. And then the Beatitudes go on even deeper beyond that point. But I was just watching a Little House on the Prairie episode this morning about an old Jewish craftsman, woodcarver, and I forgot that in that he actually talks about this amazing word in Hebrew for compassion, have compassion for each other's. And he says, it's Rachmane. And I went, Rachmanus is what it was, Rachmanus. It's Rachma. And I went, whoa, I forgot it was in the episode. You know, and that Rachma is something that develops further on in the Beatitudes. But breathe, feel, allow, or flow. That changed my life.
Well, so don't leave us hanging. Where does Rachma come in?
Well, Rachma is the fifth one. I'll just really quickly, the fourth one is hunger and thirst after righteousness. You know, kianuta is that word righteous, which people usually think self-righteous. What kianuta actually means, what kian actually means, is to, well, with uta at the end as well, it's that every breath, every action, every thought, every deed, every feeling, you are conscious that it is in the best interest of all involved, meaning not only you and the people around you, but the earth, the air, the water, the animals, etc. It's in a very ecological, you know, I can go deeper into that. But the fifth beatitude, tu vehun lam rachmane, delehun nehun rachma, or rachmane, rachme. Rachma, if you just look at it linguistically, the ra sound is a shining forth of light and heat. The hum sound is the old Hebrew word for womb or center point of being, center point of the spiritual being or the physical body. And then the last sound, the ma sound, is essentially the word for mother or birth, a birthing forth, shining forth of light and heat from the center point of the spiritual womb. And it's funny because it's Rocco. Years ago, 20 years ago, Rocco Lirico gave me this big list of all these great mistranslations of how Rachma ended up in the Old Testament from the Hebrew into Greek, and I believe the word is splugchna, and they mistranslated it horribly, like bowel movement and flatulence, and I'm not kidding, it's there, clothe yourself with bowels rather than, you know, clothe yourself with compassion and empathy, because there's a depth in that, because when one's in that moment of Rachma, an example that I give for people of what Rachma is, you know, I have a girl that she's a woman now. She grew up down the street from me, moved to California, and her son did several tours of duty in Iraq. He did 3 of them in a row, which is kind of not common. The last one he filled in for a friend who couldn't do it. And she thought he wasn't going to be home for another week. And there was this video that her husband posted on Facebook like 5 years ago or so. It might have been a little longer than that. And he was filming her as somebody was knocking at the front door. And Tammy opens the front door, and she's going, oh, my God, oh, my God, oh, my God. There's her son standing at the door. She thought she wouldn't see him for another week, but they lined it up so that he'd be there that night. And she was in that state. And you know what's happening when someone's in that state, whether it's the birth of a child, a moment of ecstasy, amazing music, you're in that moment where things line up and the soul's wide open, the untethered soul. When you're wide open like that, your bowels move. You do have, it's not a bowel movement. So there is an aspect in that, the quaking in the center of the physical body as well. But Rachma is, in Tuvehun LaRachmane, is that essentially that when you are in that place, you're in that place where you're 100% absolutely open. It doesn't matter the theology of how you translate or define this word. Everybody's had a moment in their life. Like I say, whether it's music, for me it's happened in different moments, being such a being a musician since I was 10 and having so many musician friends, it happens being out in the woods, those moments where it's like everything's just right and everything lines up after forgiveness, meaning this, not necessarily you just went through some big forgiveness process, but you're not holding on to anything in the moment. There's no goal that needs to be met right now, and until that's met, then you'll be open. It's just you're there. You've let go of the goals, the needs, and it's that matter of literally where you were talking about God bumps, you know, the God bumps. It's the quaking in the center of the spiritual body. Rachma is that. And when you approach others with that, you'll get it back. But that doesn't necessarily mean, as an example, like in the water healings that I do, it doesn't mean that the person in front of me, the participant, is just going to throw their arms around me and give me a big kiss. What that means is that Rachma within me is going to resonate Rachma within them. If they have a lot of stuff on top of that, they've got different kinds of garbage, you know, whatever. I can't remember what Ron Roth used to call it. I think he just called it the junk. He said, you know, to drop the junk and let the angels pick up the mess. But they've got that stuff on top that might come out first. And that's why, of course, it's very important. And I've seen it a bazillion times, you know, working with different amazing healers. You see it in breath work. You see it in the forgiveness process. You know, go through the worksheet, you know, Michael's worksheet, especially the children's one. That's the one I use with people because it doesn't engage so much of the brain. It keeps you on the heart level. And when they get to that point where it's, and you can't put that into words, to me, that Rachma, that's what I was feeling when I was a kid. That's what I was feeling when I was looking at that Bible. That's what I was feeling when I'm, you know, out there in the tunnel under the road toning sounds and I'm laying back in the stream going, oh. That's what I felt when our children were born. There's a whole section in my book about our youngest being born and the death of my mother. I felt Rachma in her final passing. Really, the Beatitudes build up, and that even goes to the sixth one, which is Blessed are the Pure in Heart, which is actually a decent translation. And then, of course, the one of the peacemakers. In our retreats, we go through them individually, pretty much every retreat, not in a linguistic or a brainy way, like an intellectual way. We do it from a level of intelligence of, you know, how do I actually live this? Which is the core of everything that I'm seeking to put out there. You said people had questions. I'd love to know what some of those questions are.
All right. Let me just have a breath.
Yeah, no, once I get going, it's...
Well, it's delightful. Thank you for that. We had one person who was asking from down under. Which is older? Sanskrit or Aramaic? What do you know of Sanskrit? Is it related to Aramaic or?
Well, here's the thing. We don't really, I got to put a couple things on. First of all, are they related? They had some relations. This doesn't sound right, but they did have some relations. Are they related? Not necessarily. There are words that show up that are in Aramaic and the Hindi languages and Sanskrit, such as Abraham, Abraham, his original name in the Bible was Abram, which is Father Ram. Father Ram, that's very Eastern, that's in the Sanskrit and the Hindi languages. The Aramaic and the Hindi languages did actually essentially cohabitate, and they are still in existence in a rudimentary form in different parts of India, but they're not necessarily related per se. In terms of which one is older, here's the thing. It's just like if you ask about Aramaic and Hebrew. We know that Hebrew was written down first, so a lot of scholars say, okay, that makes it older. But we also know that Aramaic was spoken 900 years before Hebrew, chicken and egg kind of thing. It depends on who you ask. My gut sort of tells me that they kind of popped up at the same time. A lot of people misrepresent Aramaic, say that it's the mother tongue, which is, I'm sorry, it's a childish statement because we know that, we know of Akkadian, Phoenician, and Sumerian alone that were there long before Aramaic by thousands and thousands of years. So I can't fully answer which is older with Sanskrit. If you see people that worked with Sanskrit more than I have, and I've dabbled but not a lot, they'll usually say that's older. I would just say the jury's out, and we'll probably never know. Akkadian, Phoenician, Sumerian goes back to 11,000 years ago, and we know there was no Aramaic then. But the syllabus, the root sounds that are in the oldest Semitic languages known are the ones that are in Aramaic, so it was still some form of those. But in terms of Sanskrit and Aramaic, can't really answer that question fully.
Okay. Well, what little I know about Sanskrit and the toning and chanting that comes with it reminds me of what I was reading in your book, Echoes of an Ancient Dream, that the actual origins of the scripts that, the scrolls that became the Bible, et cetera, was a string of characters that weren't even words, just a string of characters that were toned. And
the Torah, the beginning of Genesis. The book of Bereshit in the Hebrew, it was about 900 years but after that was first written down, before they put final markers at the end of the words, before they put spaces, because it wasn't words. It was actually meant to be read more like a mathematical algorithm than as a story. The story didn't happen of in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. That happened 900 years after the letters were first put on the page. And again, you got to look into the word. Although he's very hard-lined in his beliefs about certain things, go to meru.org, meru.org, Stan Tenen. I remember sitting in, Michael Rice's house, like the summer of 1995, watching Stan on DVD or VHS, I think, for the first time, and my jaw was dragging on the floor for like 2 weeks after that. And since then, I've got all the DVDs, and I've communicated with he and his wife, Lavana. Stan's the one that really unpacked what was there in the beginning of Genesis. And they didn't speak it as words. They toned the letters. And the real key to it was, and that's in my book, the real key to it is that each of the letters is toned consciously. You're aware of the meaning, the essence of each letter, because you can actually translate it letter by letter or word for word, Aramaic as well. Especially the more religious or sacred texts, not as much in the sort of colloquial, everyday speaking, common speaking, but they were aware of each of the letters, and they were aware of the words that could be formed from those letters, and they were also aware of the overarching energy of the entire text. And they didn't say it. They didn't say, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. They sang it. And, Bereshit, Beit Resh Aleph, Shin, Yod, Tal, and they saw that on such a depth. But now, of course, especially with the Septuagint right before Jesus was born, going into Greek, we have just this one sort of thin storyline translation of it, and if you don't look at it in the Hebrew, you're not going to get it. It's just not there. Aramaic is the same. That's all over my book.
Here's the next question in order of how it was received. A gentleman asks, it seems that many non-Jewish people today want to focus almost exclusively on the New Testament and ignore or downplay the value of Old Testament esoteric and allegorical teachings as they were part of shaping Yeshua's gospel. Do you have any comments on that?
I say absolutely. A lot do that. The Old Testament is not necessarily the Hebrew Bible, which of course is separate from those books that were written, of course, we know for a fact in Greek, and of course within the Hebrew, and including in Daniel, Ezra, Nehemiah, we know that there's Aramaic threaded within that, even within the Hebrew. And we also know that the Amidah and the Kaddish, two of the most sacred prayers of Judaism, go back and forth between Aramaic and Hebrew, even though the Hebrew speakers don't even realize that. People do, absolutely. My take on that is this. I definitely do not downplay it, and yet at the same time, I know that what I'm looking for is not outside of myself. In the words of St. Francis of Assisi, what you're looking for is what is looking. And I've been able to approach, I don't even like saying the word the Old Testament. It makes it sound less important or stodgy or moldy or something like that, smelling like a musty old book. I see the Hebrew Bible differently from, as an example, Psalms and Proverbs and that which is written in Greek. And, you know, I'm looking at those, and there's a lot of questionable stuff in the Hebrew Bible. You look at the five books of Moses, and at one point Moses is writing about his own death, and they told us that Moses wrote them. Okay, that's an interesting little miracle there. But there's so much there. God seems pissed off. Elohim seems so mad and angry. And a lot of people will throw it out because of that. But that's the thing that's the most important to remember. Jesus was Jewish. That's the amazing thing to me. When people are like, you know, Jesus was a Christian, I'm like, hello? It's like saying that he spoke English, which I had never thought of until I was like 20 years old. I'm like, wait a second. I never thought about the fact that he never spoke English. Yeah, people absolutely do that. It's very unfortunate. And yet also, by the same token, I know those I know people that study, and I studied the Kabbalistic ideas a lot for a long time, and I got a little, just like anything else, I saw people really addicted to the frames. They got addicted to turning it into some kind of a religion, to the point of an addiction to the ideas rather than allowing it to still be alive. I see that within Judaism. You can see it with some Hasidic Jews. You can see it within the Kabbalistic ideas. You can see it in the Greek Orthodox Church, the Christian Church, the New Age Church, the Unity Church, the Unitarian Church, the Centers for Spiritual Living. It's everywhere. And to the best of my ability, it's a funny thing when people ask me real technical questions, and sometimes I'll say, I don't know, or I'll also say, you know, it's not in the books, it's not in the words, but here's the answer. It's really about, how awake am I right now? How present am I? And, yeah, people do it. They throw it out all the time, I got to say. And it's unfortunate, but I got to also say not everything's going to resonate for everybody. So, yeah, it happens all the time. And actually, I'll say really quick, too. I just relaunched my mentoring program. I have a one-on-one mentoring program, weekly mentoring. You can go on my website, click on private sessions, and click on the mentoring or mentorship. That's something that I stopped doing for a while because my schedule was too busy. And that's where you can work one-on-one with me on a weekly basis, and we can go as deep as you want and as wide as you want, for anywhere from 1 week to a year. A year is the longest module that I'm offering right now. So,
fabulous. I don't have words.
I hope
so,
that's good.
It is. It is fabulous. It is. I have gratitude for your sharing the time with us. I have tears coming to my eyes. I am blessed to have known you and your work. And so I have no words.
Thank you. And I always remember, like at Unity in Woodstock, which we'd love to come back to sometime, whenever you were in the room, you were always... You weren't scribbling notes. You were like in an altered state, and you were taking it straight into the center of your consciousness, and that has always meant a lot to me. In 100,000 different ways, you were fully present. So thank you.
Well, that's the intention. It happens once in a while, but that is the intention. Yeah.
So, welcome to the second hour of Mindshifters Radio. That was a pre-recorded interview that Dr. Tim did with Dale Allen Hoffman several years ago, and it's awesome to re-listen to it. So, thank you for being with us for the second hour. We're starting a little bit early. Today is Monday, May the 30th, 2022, and our call-in number is 563-999-3581, and press 1, and that puts you in the queue to talk to us. And we'd love to hear your comments and questions, because that makes this your show. I hope that you're having a blessed Memorial Day weekend, and Michael will be dialing in here in just a moment. I see we already have a hand up, so I'm going to say hello to Susan. Welcome.
Hey, welcome back.
Thank you. It's good to be back. It was a long drive, but the wedding was so much fun, and it was just a really good time to be with the family. But yeah, definitely glad to be back.
Boy, that's a lot of driving. And how was some Heartland?
Yeah. It's in pretty good shape.
Yeah,
we stopped by there. We actually ended up spending 2 days there. There's a gentleman named Michael Yeti. Don't know how to pronounce his last name, but he is living there at Eternal Support across from our house and doing a work exchange, and so he's going to get some things up to speed. And Michael's actually talking about going back. You know, we have a granddaughter going to be born. Well, we don't know if it's a granddaughter or grandson. We have a grandchild to be born in September. And so Michael was thinking of tying it in together and being there for the entry of the child, and also then doing work week or whatever at Heartland. So this other Michael is getting things prepared ahead of time.
Nice.
Make it a little bit easier. Yeah.
Oh,
so,
good.
And how are you doing?
Well, I'm doing fine. I have Jacob here, and in fact, I can't even stay on the show because he's here, and I'm going to be joining him for a grocery shop with my son, and it's a long story. But
yeah.
I have a question that I want to ask you, and I hope I can ask him without – I'm up in my study and hoping he won't hear, but I need a little support.
Okay. Well, fine. Let me see here.
If that would be getting on –
Well, you know you've got it. I'm here. Hey, young lady.
Welcome back, Michael.
You were I woke up with you on my mind this morning. I almost called to just see how you were doing from your journey to Florida. So I'm glad to hear your voice.
Oh, thanks. I'm back. It was a week long, and I came back a week ago. So time does just go so fast. It was a strange visit in a lot of ways because Jacob isolated himself. I didn't see much of him, and I didn't want to just throw him out of his room and make him go for walks. I just, you know, we cooked together one time and went for a couple of walks, and he was more talkative when he had had a drink or two. He generally is not, he doesn't drink much, but he feels he needs a little pot and a little alcohol to get himself loosened up. And he is much, much better. And he's going on Wednesday to New York to a theater program. And I think he's ready. I think he's ready to step back into his life. But here's my question. Yesterday he was singing these audition songs for me. And he kept saying, my voice is not what it used to be. And I said, well, are you still vaping? Are you still doing pot? And he said, yeah, and I know it hurts my voice. And I said, and you feel you need the pot? And he says, I really do. And I don't overuse it. I just use a little bit at night. It helps me sleep, and it helps me relax. And so I'm not arguing with him, but I said, well, is there a way you could take the pot that wouldn't hurt your throat if you're going to take it? He said, yeah, I could do it with using a bong. Do you know what a bong is?
Michael, I hear you talking through the wall, but not on the speaker.
See if my mute button
Michael?
Was on. Yeah, you've seen probably Cheech and Chong on TV, and they have a glass device with water in it, and they draw the smoke through the water, and so it's supposed to cool
right.
it, and I don't know, make it more palatable, I guess. Humidify it, I don't know. Nick, it's
but
also
it still gets
in
your lungs.
The throat.
What?
Yeah, you're still taking the smoke into your lungs, but... So that's what a bong is. I am familiar with that. I used to be in the music business, so I've got to see lots of that take place. I'm so thankful that I had the knowledge of drugs when I got into the music business because it wasn't an attraction to me.
Yeah, me too. I feel the same. Well, so I said, well, why don't you, if you're going to do it, why don't you use a bong? And he said, it's too expensive. And I wasn't going to offer to buy it for him, but he said,
Brian.
I want you to say that again. I want to videotape you saying it. My grandmother is suggesting I use a bong. It's like it blew his mind, as if I was giving him permission.
Yeah, like you were the one who had originated it.
Right. Yeah. So you know what he did? He went right out and spent $60 of his own money and bought himself a bong. Well, I talked to my daughter this morning, and she said, "Oh, Mom, you're supposed to be trying to get him off that stuff." And I said, "Callus, nothing I say is going to get him off of it. So I thought the best thing to do was have the least harmful form of it until he gets himself off of it." So my daughter and I are, she was nice to me, but she was disappointed. She thinks I ought to go into Al-Anon. And I feel as if my work with you is Al-Anon. I hope it is. Codependency
right.
work.
Right.
So I said, I am, and I don't really think this is, it's not my place to tell him that I'm not going to have anything to do with him and tell him he has to get off of it. He's not going to do that. So anyway,
right.
I would
right.
love your take on my dilemma here. So
my input would be that it falls into your old thing about being to blame. So there'd be some work in that direction. But for me, the tool I would use out of our tools in communication with your daughter at this point would be a really detailed responsibility communication and letting her know what you're dealing with and asking her for her support in, you know, what all is going on for you, but also communicating with her that, you know, you're doing the best you can do to support this young man in healing, and that it's clear to you that just nixing everything is not working for him. It hasn't worked. It's not going to work. But minimizing damage is a reasonable thing. And so, you know, and a way to open rapport and communication with him, which could open the space for, you know, him to really do some real healing work. So that would be the approach I take, is some responsibility communication and let her know that you are 1,000% on the team for him getting off, and it's reasonable for him to minimize the damage while he's doing it. You know, he obviously isn't stopping under her tutelage or yours or anybody else's at this point. That'd be kind
of
my approach.
I'm so glad to hear you say that. Well, I did it that way, Michael. I said, "Kathis, I am doing the best I can, and I got the channels open with him. I want them to stay
right.
open. If it means just what you said, I stood my ground. I was so proud of myself. I've been doing my worksheets. I did 8 worksheets this morning, Michael."
Right. Opportunities to learn forgiveness. How cool is that?
I'm no kidding. And 2 of them had to be on my daughter, you know, and my interaction with her. But in spite of my feeling...
Can I throw in a thought?
Yeah.
Can I throw in a thought? So I'd offer that, you know, when you do a worksheet and you've got an object of attention, it looks like you're doing a worksheet on that object of attention. The truth is, what you're doing a worksheet on is what your daughter brought up for you.
Oh, yeah. That's
it's really not on your
that
daughter.
Is so true.
You know, what came up in you was, oh, here I am. I've flubbed again. I'm going to be blamed. You know, you're standing in front of your grandfather again, you know, being blamed for something that you didn't do.
Yep, that's true. That's true. That's good.
And how cool is it that you didn't fold back into that whole just shut down and go into agreement with it, that you were able to stand your ground and be clear, you know, this is what I'm doing. And I think you could enhance that by putting it in the form of a written responsibility communication, you know, to follow the format on the website where David wrote a letter to his father around alcohol.
Right.
Interesting.
I remember
that. Similarity. Yeah.
Yeah.
And you know, the thought comes that it might even be, you know, I've never suggested this to anyone before, but it might be worth taking that letter that David wrote to his father and sending it to her and saying, look, here's what a young man did who had a problem with alcohol and his father doing alcohol, and he was an alcoholic and he got out of it. And look, I'm working to communicate as responsibly as I can with you. And I'm looking to create a space for your son to be able to open to this truth. and to clear his mind of these past things. So something that isn't so personal example, such as David writing to his father, and that's a powerful letter, might give her an insight, especially with her, you know, training in the church, might give her a little different perspective and the ability, you know, and it'll enhance her whole communication skills. I actually got a letter this morning from let me get to it here just a second. So Michelle Pache, you know, who does the radio show oftentimes, dropped me, sent me a communication that she had gotten on her website. It's like a two-paragraph, just glowing review of her therapeutic work with Michelle. And Michelle wrote, "I got this Google review." You do know when she's talking about the tools, she's talking about the Aramaic forgiveness tools. Although they didn't always put it in writing, I have dozens of clients just like her. I'm sharing this today because I appreciate you and thank you for teaching me so well. I'm a master teacher and healer because of what I've learned over the last 9 years. By the way, Michael, our anniversary is this weekend, so this is her 9th year of working with the tools as a therapist. And so perhaps doing a third party thing with her, like David's letter, might give her some ministerial skills even on another level. You know, Michelle, a few years ago, we actually did an intensive up at her house in Michigan. And during that intensive, she said, you know, as a therapist, I never had a clue about any of this. And now she's like, I'm so empowered. And when the therapeutic world finds out about this teaching, they're going to be blown away because they don't have a clue. So giving her something that, you know, that might give her a way to see things differently than, you know, and it sounds like she's got kind of a narrow view of, I have a straight line and we got to get this kid off. And that's what, where there's no room for flexibility and processing might broaden her horizons. And who knows?
Yeah. Hang on, Michael. One sec. Hi, Jake. Do you want to print some music? Jacob just walked in.
Tell me, say hello.
So, Michael, that is very helpful. I'm going to get off, and you're okay? Oh, okay. All right, I can stay on. Yeah. Jacob's in the room printing music for his music program. I'm talking to Michael Rice, Jake.
How sweet. Awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. Jacob, tell what you said to me about something that I told you Michael said that stuck with you. Do you remember what it is?
No.
About blame?
No.
Okay. He's forgotten it. He said, there's no use in blaming or something like that. Yeah. Blaming makes you into the victim. Yeah. I loved it. Well,
way to give away the power.
Yeah. You give away your power, right?
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. It's...
Well, thank you.
Sweet.
Very helpful. Yeah. So. I'll let you get on with the radio show, and you can mute me, and I might even be leaving. But thank you, and I'll be on in a regular way after Wednesday, on Wednesday and after.
Cool. So
for
you're
sure,
still in Florida?
And perhaps tomorrow, too. No, I'm home, but Jacob's up here now. He's been
For
a week
cool.
with us, and he's heading for a New York program in theater on Wednesday morning.
Oh, awesome.
And
well, tell him we send uplifting love in the direction of supporting him.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I will. I'll
Sweet.
Tell him. Yeah. Thanks, Michael.
You
Thanks,
are
Jeannie,
an
welcome
awesome.
Back.
You are an awesome grandma. You are a blessing.
Thanks.
It's pretty
That's
powerful.
Nice
pretty sweet. All right, young lady. We appreciate you. Cherish you.
All right. Thanks. Thanks
okay,
a lot.
Bye bye.
Okay. You too. Bye.
Very sweet. What an opportunity to have these tools. What a gift. Every mind, heart, and being on the planet is the image, is the goal, is the ultimate purpose. One of the factors in doing that is, in taking these tools forward, or one of the tools involved is what people do with putting nutrition into their bodies. And I was talking to a chiropractor friend of mine, a physician friend, and I had sent him a picture. You know, you might remember last year we talked about the fact that we didn't have tomato plants last year. We've been really nourishing the soil, really building soil. We had tomato trees. Our tomato trees were over 10 feet tall. The year before, they were like 4, 4.5, 5 feet tall, vital, good tomatoes. But last year, they were over 10 feet. And this year, we have romaine trees. Our romaine trees, the tallest one's about 5 feet tall. And I just got out in the garden before the show started to pick a leaf and measure it. And I have a romaine leaf in my hand right now. It's this deep, dark green. You know, you go to the store and you buy romaine and there's a lot of white and such. Well, literally right down into the vein in the center of it, everything is deep, dark green. And the leaf is 10 inches long and 6 inches wide. So, you know, and just so dark green, so loaded with nutrition. It's amazing. And just a reminder that food, that what we put in our bodies, the energy we put into our forms is a really key ingredient, a really key factor in the deepest levels of healing that we need to do. And though we may think that investing our lives in going out and making money is what it's really about, the truth is, and I shared yesterday the story of Art Garfunkel and what he did as a broke young man to assist a friend of his who literally had given up. And when he was pronounced blind in, I guess, early college and quit and isolated himself. And, you know, there's a lot more to the game than, you know, what we can put in our pockets and what we can spend. So take time, grow yourself a garden. People say, oh, I don't have room for a garden. You know, we've got a small device that's about, maybe 16 inches by 8 inches by 5 inches. Portable light on it. It was $70, and it just grows all kinds of greens right in one little corner in the kitchen. And so there are lots of ways to do it besides doing a garden. We started up the first year, and we had a little space that was about 4 feet by 12 feet. And then we went out and got some soil and got some leaves and got some greens and started compost. And we expanded that by another 5 feet. And then the next step was we started on another five by five space, and that grew into where now this whole beautiful space is about 15 by 15. Both of us were out there working on that this morning. Build soil. You know, the experts tell us that we're about 60 years from the end of soil on the planet. We've turned soil into dirt. You can't grow food in dirt. You can grow chemically augmented pseudo food in dirt, but you can't grow food without soil. And the soil through chemical farming has been just about destroyed. And desertification, you know, the way that we allow animals to utilize the earth. I mean, the whole thing is just a big wake-up call. And really, we need to heal from the ground up. And that means not from our feet up, but from what's under our feet and turning what has become dirt into soil and feeding the soil and feed the organisms in the soil so that they can feed us. And it's an important factor. It's an important piece of the puzzle if you're not thinking about it. If you think that going out to Mickey D's is a way to get some nutrition into your body, you've been conned, you've been scammed. There's no nutrition there. It's just, it's amazing to watch the film Supersize Me, if you have any questions about that. Powerful look at what the sophistry of the so-called food industry. And what we call the food industry really isn't a food industry anymore. It isn't food. There's almost no food left in America unless you grow it yourself. And yes, there are some farmers who are really turning into, you know, developing soil and building soil and growing actual food and becoming actual farmers again. But the agribusiness isn't a food business anymore. It's agri. It's a chemical business. and the history is beyond comprehensible. But a good clue is the largest seed company in the world is also the largest manufacturer of chemicals that were designed for war and designed to kill people. Agent Orange. And we could go on and on and on with that, but just think about it. The people who started in business creating chemicals to kill people now own most of the seed patents in the world. And when you think about it, it should be an oxymoron, a seed patent. You can't patent what is natural. You can only patent what is unnatural. It's the only way you can own something. You might want to just for fun's sake, Google Bayer. You think it's an aspirin company. Google Bayer patents Hitler. You see what words would get you there. Bayer patents Hitler. And I'm trying to think of the doctor involved. Rath, R-A-T-H. Put those four words into a search engine and look for an article by Dr. Rath, and you will be shocked. And a whole political party has grown up around protecting that insanity. And it's just time for us to wake up and function as human beings and heal from the ground up. So that's what we're here to support. That's what we're here to be part of. And then I'll breathe through this 10-by-6-inch dark green romaine leaf, the power of this nutritional energy to our whole globe and to everyone listening. And I invite you to participate on any and every level that you can. We're here to create support. We're here in particular to understand that we are not physical beings. We are energetic beings. And as energy beings, there are basically two qualities of energy relative to our function. One of them is integrative, one of them is disintegrative. Now, we've had sophists, and remember the sophists were a group of Greek philosophers who traveled around Greece charging big bucks to the wealthy to teach the wealthy, the children of the wealthy, how to lie and make their lies sound true. And we've been so flooded and surrounded with sophistry that it's beyond comprehension. And so anything that's based in any form of hostility or fear that presents itself as beneficial to you or helpful to you is a lie, period. If it's not based in love, it's not based in human life, it will not support human life. There are people who will fight for it and murder for it because what it does is it puts money in their pockets. But if it's not based in love, it's not based in life. And so this work is an invitation to wake up from anything that you've been indoctrinated with that's based in hostility and fear, or any of its cousins, hate and rage and guilt and grief and condemnation and gossip and slander and vengeance. Anything based in any of that energy is literally death. And forgiveness is simply a tool to remove death. What is life? If you've ever held a newborn child, you know, if you've tapped into the essence of the newborn, that the newborn is the presence of love. And my offering would be that the best definition I've been able to come up with for life is that life is love flowing through a cell. If you go back to the man Yeshua, He doesn't say, I come to bring you dogma or doctrine. He says, I come to bring you life and life more abundantly. I come to teach you who you are as love and how to forgive, how to remove everything unlike the truth of you. And it doesn't matter who you're taking your hate and your fear and your rage and your crazy dramas and traumas out on, whether it's your children or yourself when you look in the mirror, whether it's your spouse or the person next door to you or the neighbor or the immigrant, whoever it is. If you're taking it out on anybody, then you're inhibiting the flow of love through your cellular structure, and that's what leads to death. And all death is suicide, and we've been taught in this culture to kill ourselves. Oh, a little rage, a little hate, a little fear, a little intimidation. Hey, everybody needs those things. They don't mean anything. Yeah, they do. They're how we kill ourselves. So this man, Yeshua, 2,000 years ago, gave us a technology with which to remove death. And we're here to support making that available on a global scale. It's so simple. It's so straightforward. If you're not using the forgiveness process, go to the website, whyagain.org, and click on the book. The book's free. Download it. Read it. Unfortunately, we don't have any we can sell you. It's out of print, and I don't know whether we're going to print it or not. Again, we've got so much on our plate. But you can download it and print it free. Or you can go to Amazon or eBay, and they've always got used copies. Read the book. The worksheet process, you can do the forgiveness process live right on the website and, you know, process. The biggest inhibitor to doing the process of forgiveness is, I don't want to look, and you better shut up and stop forcing me to look at what's inside of me. If you force me to look at what's inside of me, I will rage at you, I will destroy you, I will leave you, I will kill you. That's basically what the brainwashed mind of the world says. And ours is an invitation. Ours is an invitation to grow up, to be responsible for, and to begin to move out of the brainwash and to take the energetic loads off of your own cellular structure so that you can have life and have it more abundantly. People drug themselves, people use alcohol in order to try to hide those things from themselves. You can run, but you can't hide. You go back into the ancient scriptures and they talk about nothing will remain hidden. Everything will be made known in the light of the day. Light of day, it's all going to come out. Engage in forgiveness, and you remove everything that never belonged, and what you get is a human life. Connect to the higher source of intelligence in you, which is the brain located in the heart. Link it up with the brain located in what we call your brain, and all of a sudden, you've got a whole new game happening. Use the forgiveness process on the website. There are several different versions of the worksheet. Pick one you like most. Start to use it. Download it. Print it. Start to use it. And or go to your app store on your phone. Type in the words Heartland, H-E-A-R-T-L-A-N-D, Aramaic, A-R-A-M-A-I-C, forgiveness. You will be looking at the world's only forgiveness app. It's virtually free of permissions, therefore it is totally, completely private. You can put anything in it you want, and you're the only one who will ever be able to see it. Take it, put it to work. If questions come up from within the app, on every page, you can hit a button and send us a question. We'll answer it here on the radio show, and we'll send you back an email that'll tell you when and where we answered it so you can access the answer. We want you to have this technology. We want you to become proficient at using this technology. That's why we do this show. That's why we do everything we do. So we're honored and delighted that you're part of our conversation today. If you're on one of those stations where we can't see you, our call-in number is 563-999-3581. If you're on one of those stations and you dial that number, 563-999-3581, we'll be having a conversation. If you push 1, Gene will introduce you by area code and let's talk about it. How can we support you? What's on your mind? Questions, answers, ideas, anything you'd like to share from your experience of working with the tools.
Okay, we
by the way,
have
Bob,
a question in the chat room.
Okay, let me just offer a quick shout out to Bob if he happens to be on the show today. I'm still using, like, it's become my favorite quote, the Groucho Marx quote that you gave us a couple of weeks ago. Bob, thank you for that. That is such a precious quote. And the quote is, power is only necessary to do damage. Love. I don't have the whole thing memorized, but love is what's required to do truth. And that's not exactly the words, but Groucho Marx said it so powerfully. So thanks for that, Bob. It's awesome. Go ahead, Jeannie.
Okay, we have a question in the chat room, and then I have a hand up.
Great.
And so this is Kathy, and she says she just came back from Colombia. By mistake, she drank some bioethanol just to sip, but
ouch.
She realized what it was. Yeah, now she's feeling the effects of it. What can she do to neutralize the effect?
What I'd be doing is I'd get to the closest store you can find yourself some charcoal and water. And or... you know, I don't know how much you drank, whether you're in an emergency, call 911. Get to a medical facility. I'm not sure bioethanol is a new, you know, knowing
it's
what ethanol
fuel,
is. Well, I'm not sure whether it's a fuel. I'm not sure. It sounds like it. And so if you're in a crisis, I'd get 911 or I'd get to an emergency facility. ASAP, and or, you know, I know one store that you can readily get charcoal in, you know, activated charcoal, and it's in the supplement department at Walmart. You can grab some, but I'd definitely be getting some of that in my body quickly, and I'm just not sure, but I'd call 911 and ask. With bioethanol, you might want to induce vomiting or not. I'm just not sure. You know, it's a form of alcohol. I'm not sure whether inducing vomiting is wise there or not. I'd Google it or I'd call 911 and see what they say.
Poison control, yeah, they could tell you.
Yeah. Yeah, poison control.
All right. Well, we hold you in space.
So we are sending love in your direction, young lady.
Absolutely. And let us know what they say. And
yes,
the hand
I would love some
is,
input on it, please.
Yes. The hand is Joan, area code 205. You're on the air.
Well, young lady, we haven't heard your voice in a while. Welcome. Good to hear from you.
Good to hear the program. I would like for you to speak about the difference in dissociation and disassociation.
Sure. So the way that we utilize the word dissociation in this work comes from the recognition that perception is a construct of the mind. And as such, the mind can only use data that it is given permission to use. And so when I live in denial, when I and that means when I think or speak as though something outside of me is a cause of something that's moving inside of me, then I literally instruct my mind that there's certain data that it is not allowed to utilize in structuring my perception. So I dissociate from that content. So let's say, let me give an example. On the British Hear My Voice book study club a couple of days ago, a young lady who actually runs the club shared that she had done a worksheet. And she wasn't specific about the worksheet was about, but it was kind of a, you know, she was just committed to doing a worksheet at a time. And so it was kind of a relatively meaningless one. But once she completed it, and this was kind of her point of just the power of that worksheet, and all of a sudden she had this like major insight that had been running her life from the time she was a child. And she had no idea it was there. She dissociated from it. And the idea, the thought disorder was, I don't deserve to be here. And she realized, and this is a young woman in her late 30s, I guess. I hope I'm in alignment there if you're listening, Yinka. And she realize that she's lived her whole life with this thought under the surface, but she had dissociated from it. It had been hidden from her. She didn't know it was there. And one of the ideas of the forgiveness process is to touch into that dissociated content. So when I deny, I dissociate, I hide things from myself that would change my life if I knew them, but it's kind of like that process of you made me mad, so now here I am believing that you're the cause of the mad that's moving in me. I have to hide from myself the real cause. I have to dissociate from it. So it's no longer mine to change. It's underlying everything, but I have no idea that it's underlying what I'm thinking now or what I was thinking 10 minutes ago or what I was thinking 10 years ago. People who live in a dissociated state have no idea what's really running their lives. Forgiveness, and you know, you've done enough worksheets, I suspect, to recognize how many times you've touched into something and gone, oh my God, I didn't know that was in me. So that's our dissociated state. It's kind of like, you know, having a file on your computer, you put a password on the file, and then you throw away the password. Well, you can't access that file in the computer anymore. So dissociation is that. Disassociation, on the other hand, usually happens when people are abused. It usually happens with younger children when abuse occurs, although it can happen at any time in life. And the abuse is so overwhelming that this person literally, it's kind of like they shrink up, disconnect from their own body-mind unit, disconnect from life, and go away. Disassociate. They've literally disconnected from their own lives. So disassociation is different than dissociation in that way. Does that kind of get what you were looking for?
Could you use disassociation in a sentence that would illustrate?
Yes. So the young man was put in a mental institution because he was so disassociated from his life that he could not function. He was so disconnected from his life that he could not function. And then using the dissociation in the sentence would be during the book cover, book study a couple of days ago, a young lady shared that she uncovered with the worksheet something she dissociated from that was underlying her life and she didn't know it. And when she got in touch with it, she was able to totally de-energize, totally be free of that. And so that would be using it in a dissociation in a sentence. Does that make sense and fit?
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
Cool. Is there any underlying thought or any underlying way we can support you by how that gets applied, or is there a specific that we can assist you with in that regard?
I was working with somebody on a worksheet, and I was unable, but kept reading the word dissociation as disassociation.
Yeah,
I was unable to distinguish the two.
Okay. Well, it's pretty common because dissociation is not, you know, unless one's a psychologist or very acquainted with the world of psychology, it tends not to be a word that most people comprehend or have worked with.
Right.
Okay. And when I'm complete, I'd actually, someone had asked that question on Facebook a little while back, and when I find the answer that I gave them, I'll send that to you so you've got something in writing too, and I'll send it to Jeannie to put in the notes.
Great. Thank you.
Cool.
Can I give a personal example?
Oh, please.
Disassociation. And I didn't realize that I was doing it until, you know, when Michael and I were first started dating, and he would occasionally ask me, you know, a penny for my thoughts. And it'd be like I wasn't thinking of anything, but it was like I had left the room. I was still there physically, but it was like I was in a blank stare or something. And what we started doing is when he would notice that I would do that, is to instead of saying, what are you thinking, because I wasn't, what just happened? You know, did the lights go down? Did the music change? Did a certain person walk by? You know, what happened to trigger me leaving? Because basically that's what I did. And what it was is when I, from the time I was 16 to 19, I had gotten married, and I was abused every day. And didn't get out of it because I thought, you know, well, he's my husband. He can do what he wants to with me. But I would disassociate. I would, like, basically leave my body and hang out somewhere else so that I didn't feel the full impact of what he was doing to me physically. And so it's like I wasn't even in my body. And so then what would happen, what we, you know, and doing a lot of worksheets around it, but that when something happened that was similar, whether it was the build of a person, whether it was a song that came on or whatever, that it triggered that file of I've got to get out of here to not feel this. And so the totally leaving the space, even though I was physically there, that's disassociation.
Right. Okay. That's very good. Thank you.
And Yinka wrote in the chat room, she said the worksheet that she was working on was just on why would I get annoyed with my thoughts as I'm running the session. And so she didn't want to dig into anything deep as she was holding the space for other people as they were processing. And she was certainly surprised when such a deep belief came up from doing that simple worksheet. And she says, I was shocked at how much of my life was being impacted by the thought that I shouldn't be here. I got a flashback on how much of my decisions were made from that belief unknowingly that I shouldn't be here. Powerful.
Yeah, so that's a they're two really good examples of disassociating from something. And the other piece of dissociation, when I live in denial, when I deny, I hide something. And then, you know, what I hide because I've denied it, I've actually intensified, I've actually amplified it on an energetic level, which means I sent it out on another level. And somebody who's in resonance with it is going to tend to show up and do a behavior motivated by what I sent out. And they're going to resonate that content that I've dissociated from inside of me on an even deeper level. And what I'll do is, and this is the third piece in the cycle, is I'll then use that content to build my brain's image of them. I mean, literally here. That associated content, when triggered by someone else, is used to build the brain's image, literally the perceptual construct. The body that I think belongs to that other person, that picture in my mind, is built of my own dissociated content. And that's how they show up in my mind with my problem attached. And I swear that it must be their problem.
Right. Yeah.
And so I'm sending you a text, and Jeannie, I'll send it to you too so you can put it in the notes. Here's the I found the note I'd made to someone who'd asked the question. Dissociation versus disassociation is the act of thinking, or disassociation is the act of thinking or speaking as though something outside of you is the cause of what is moving inside of you. The most common action that results in dissociation is blame. You made me mad. In order to generate a perceptual construct consistent with the blame lie, one must dissociate or hide the real cause. It is the dividing from one's own mind which creates an unnatural condition called the unconscious. In this state, all perception is an hallucination designed to hide the truth. And then the second part, dissociation is what happens when life and perception becomes more than one can handle and one separates from their lives, just kind of checks out altogether. So I just sent you that in a text, Joan.
Okay,
and I'll
great.
Send it to you
Thanks
too, Jeannie.
Much.
You are so welcome. Thank you for the question. It's a powerful one. It's an important one.
Yeah.
For sure. Well, is there anything else exciting happening in your world? I'm delighted to hear that you're working on worksheets with people. That's awesome.
Yes, I actually am working with two people. And, you know, of course, I can't do a worksheet with somebody else without it having an effect on me.
That's the gift.
Wonderful. Yeah. It certainly is.
That's the gift for sure.
And it's a good feeling to know that I have tools that are beneficial to people. It's a very good feeling.
Well, you know, dear heart, you know more about forgiveness than 99.999% of psychiatrists, psychologists, doctors, ministers that have ever lived on planet Earth. So you are eminently qualified to support people through it. You know, I my mind is constantly enlarged and boggled every time I watch somebody do a worksheet. Every time I do a worksheet and see the result of what people access and the power that it has, it's just beyond comprehension. And it amazes me how many people, when it comes to the man Yeshua, they've named him Jesus, but that wasn't his name, are engaging in what are by and large silly conversations based in beliefs about him rather than the work that he taught. Dogmas and doctrines and fear and terrorizing, you know, it's just amazing, just beyond comprehension. And the power of what he brought, and, you know, thank you for being part of the team that's restoring the understanding on a global scale by sharing it with others. That's just awesome.
Yes, it really is.
Yay. Well, we're glad you're part of the team for sure. So anything else exciting in your world? Anything else that you have to share with us?
Well, the Unity of Birmingham has a new minister. And,
that's awesome.
Part-time, but about 3 Sundays ago, I was listening to him in the service, and it just occurred to me that for the first time since Jerry died, I feel like Unity of Birmingham is creating from nothing instead of trying to recreate the past. So
that's awesome.
Yeah, it is.
I bet Jerry and Jane are just, you know, clapping up a storm.
Yeah, I imagine they are too.
Very sweet. Well, tell the minister I said hello and send my love and support. And if there's ever any way we can be of support, we're here to do it.
Wonderful. I'll do that.
Cool. Well, anything else on your mind?
No. No, I'm good. Thank you. It's so good to hear both your voices.
Well, it's a delight to hear yours as well. Have a blessed day.
We have another question in the chat room.
Great.
And
let's go for it.
It's Yanka, and she says, how did you, speaking to me, I guess, get yourself to stop dissociating from it, even though I can see this belief, the habit, I can see that Michael just speaking, I'm still dissociating and looking at others like it's them. Literally, I just did it today. Could I also have the difference between the dissociation and disassociation sent to me in a message as well? And I'll also put it in the notes for today, too.
It'll be in the notes, and I will send it to you for sure.
And it just takes practice.
You know, one of the things that I do, Yinka, in an intensive, is people ask questions, and it gets to be kind of a, just like kind of the family joke in the intensive, because I'll take my marker and turn on the board, and I'll write, and I usually write it once, and then 30 times through the intense, I'll leave it on the board, and I write over it again and again and again. All of the above, every tool that we teach is about how to do that. You know, one of the tools we talk about in the codependence, you'll run into this as you start to get into the intensive videos, is we'll talk about becoming the thinker apart from the thought, the feeler apart from the feelings, the actor apart from the actions, the witness, the observer of your own mind. And when you can do that, you start to see on deeper and deeper levels. And every tool is designed to open that space. So it's just a process, and I'm delighted that you're engaged in it, and I will send you a copy of that definition that I gave. So, any
All
other
right.
thoughts for you, Yinka?
She hasn't written anything else, and we don't have another hand
okay.
up.
Okay. Well, we've still got about 10 minutes, so there's room for lots more conversation. How can we support you? What's happening out there? If you push one, and or Yinka, I don't know if you've tried, if you can get in on Skype, it'd be nice to have a conversation with you on the show. That would be cool. Otherwise, if you're out there in listening land, go ahead, sweetie.
She says, how do you do it on Skype? There should be, it's not showing up on mine, but when you are in the chat room, there should be somewhere up near the top call in. I'm just looking, it's not showing on mine, but it's usually got a Skype button. I don't see it on mine. I wonder if they changed that. And mine may look different because I'm on as, like, host, but should be able to Skype call in. And the book club that we're talking about, we do, Michael is part of it, on the second and fourth Thursday of every month until we're complete. Yeah, she says there's no Skype button on hers either. I will drop a line to the help desk and ask them if they've done away with that or what.
I hope not. Didn't Bob tap in via Skype just a couple weeks ago there?
He did. So I don't know if you can just dial the number using, you know, like open up your Skype account and just dial the number in from there. I'm not sure if it works like that.
I would think that would work if they just dialed the 563-999-3581. That would seem like it should work. So if you're out there in listener land, how can we support you? What's on your mind? Our calling number is 563-999-3581. And we're here to engage with you and support you in getting the finest little points of this process opened up. We've got a link, by the way, for Yinka's Book Club in England. It happens the second and fourth Thursday of the month
at
8:30 in the evening, England time, and 3:30 in the afternoon, our time. So there are archives there that you can listen to. And we've got them on the website as well. So, and if you want to participate, second and fourth Thursday at 3:30 in the afternoon, Eastern time. So come and play.
And I just got an answer from Blog Talk, and it says if the guest has a Skype paid service, so not the free Skype, but a paid Skype, that they can connect by calling in.
Huh. So does that mean they have to maybe just send back a note and just say, does that mean they have to pay for the call? But Skype to Skype should be free, so.
Number is not a Skype number, I don't think. It's just a regular calling number. So I'll find out more about that.
Okay, cool. Yeah, let's get our understanding of that refined. So we've got about 7 minutes left. How can we support you? What's on your mind? 563-999-3581. Let's have a conversation. What's on your mind? And by the way, in terms of until we have somebody who's got a thought for us in terms of forgiveness, you'll notice that unless you're just a really, miserable person, you're pretty happy with most everybody in your life as long as they're doing what you want them to do. Yeah? We have goals for people, goals for ourselves. Notice we're happy with ourselves. We're happy with others, or at least relatively so, as long as they're fulfilling our goals. This piece of understanding will open your understanding of forgiveness. You'll recognize that forgiveness has nothing whatsoever to do with letting somebody else off the hook because there's pain moving in you. And the key way into healing the pain is the goal that you load into your mind that accesses or brings that pain into play so that you feel it. So you'll remember there's some Harvard research that shows that in a time frame where 10,000 brain cells fire, literally there are 10,000 measurable units of electrical activity happening in the brain. In that time frame, the max amount of data that moves in the conscious mind is 9 bits. So 9 bits out of 10,000 brain cells are firing. Obviously, something in the mind has to determine which 9 bits of data your mind is using. My offering is that it's your goals. Goals determine it's like the driver for the process. The goal determines what data the mind uses. If the mind uses data that holds pain, dissociated pain, unconscious pain, and here's the key way. This took me 35 years working full-time with this Aramaic forgiveness process to understand that when you cancel the goal, the pained perception, the data that's being used as a result of that driver driving the process of perception, that perceptual construct collapses in on itself. And when it collapses in on itself, that's what gives you access to the hidden part of your mind. So Yinka shared she's doing a worksheet on, whatever it was she's doing a worksheet on. She cancels that goal, and all of a sudden, the underlying pain part of the mind, I don't belong here, I don't deserve to be here, is exposed. And that's how you get to access those hidden parts of the mind. If you listen to psychology and psychiatry, they'll say, oh, well, that's what you lay on the couch for 20 years to find. Well, you don't have to lay on the couch for 20 years. All you have to do is a worksheet. Your level of willingness is going to impact how much you're able to see of what's going on in your own unconscious mind, how much you're able to access of what's hidden from you, and it's a process. So engage in the process and everything changes. So delighted to be on the team. We're down to the last few seconds. Appreciate you being here. And the best year yet of your eternal life. It's an awesome gift to give the world. Blessings. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to Mind Shifters Radio with Dr. Michael Rice and myself, Jeannie Rice, and Dr. Tim Hayes and Michelle Pichet, as we present the first century Aramaic internal process of forgiveness. We are here for 2 hours every Monday through Friday from 12 noon to 2 o'clock Eastern Time on Mind Shifters Radio. For more information on Aramaic forgiveness, please visit www.whyagain.org. That's www.whyagain.org.